WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Priests listen to people's troubles. It is more infrequent that we are privy to the doubts of priests. Father John McNamee shares many of his doubts in his memoir, Diary of a City Priest, a journal of 1 year at St. Malachy's in North Philadelphia. It's an inner-city neighborhood where he says people have nothing, nothing works, and mayhem is frequent. Although he feels he serves an important role in the community, he knows that he is also something of an outsider, a white man in an African-American neighborhood, a priest in a neighborhood of few Catholics. Father McNamee is now 60. He was ordained in 1959. Before we talk, I want you to hear an excerpt of his book, Diary of a City Priest. This entry is from a winter day when he sought comfort at the Academy of Music, where the Philadelphia Orchestra was performing works by Vivaldi and Prokofiev. But he was distracted by his thoughts.
Why can I not simply be here, enjoy the music, allow it to refresh me, to help me believe more easily for this while, if I can? Or why do I need to believe anything at all? I sense people are not so distracted. Perhaps life makes sense, perhaps not. In either case, the music is able to be enjoyed, and we have to live on, meaning or no meaning. Perhaps being a priest is the problem. Tomorrow is Sunday, and people will come to church, and I shall have to say something to them that makes sense to myself as well as them. Perhaps being a priest is so connected with life having some meaning that the modern world threatens me. I suspect a conspiracy of silence out there. People are courteous to us priests, not telling us that they cannot and need not and do not believe any more everything or anything that we stand for. What do I do with my doubt? Spend more time listening to Vivaldi? Let the doubt paralyze? Exercise faith like some muscle that improves with workouts? Perhaps this holding on with fragile grasp is the human condition, something I should endure more patiently and calmly. Even Paul said we only see dimly as in a dark mirror. And Simone Weil and also John of the Cross, I suspect, say that God is more like nothing than any of our images. One response that I do not want in myself is to run with some excess, proclaiming the social relevance of faith. I fear that is what is happening in Catholic colleges, where often enough any traditional doctrinal courses are simply not available and theology or whatever becomes exposure to the teacher's agenda of social concerns. I think that Dorothy Day would have believed everything she did, even if the world did not need her spiritual or corporal works of mercy.
That's Father John McNamee reading from his memoir, Diary of a City Priest. Now, I'm wondering what you do with your doubts if you feel that you should protect other people from your doubts, because we usually think of it as the priest's role to strengthen people's faith, not to strengthen their doubts.
Well, I think maybe somewhere else in the book, I talk about how much I learned from Graham Greene, the novelist, who was a Catholic. And he accepted doubt as part of the human condition. And he said it's human to doubt. And it makes one hold on more firmly because one is more aware of one's precarious stance. And so that I think I've learned, as I didn't know when I was younger, I think I have learned to live with doubt as expression of the human condition. And again, it's a very, very real way of being in my neighborhood where people live with such uncertainty. Their uncertainties are financial, familial, relational, the precariousness of marriages under such stress and strain. And so I say, well, the gospel says, blessed are the poor in spirit. So if even I experience my faith as a poor kind of holding on, well, then maybe that's the best kind of faith, one that is sort of precarious and tentative. And maybe if people learn to accept their doubts and believe anyhow. There's a my training would have been in the scholastic tradition, in which faith is a gift. It is grace informing the will to accept what is not intellectually self-evident.
In the passage that you read, you basically expressed your distrust for people who proclaim the social relevance of their faith. That when you have doubts, you're not going to turn to the social relevance of your faith as a way to hold on to it. Why not?
I would want social relevance or social concern to flow from faith, but I would want it to be firmly rooted in faith. And I wouldn't want to substitute social relevance for faith and say religion is worthwhile because of all the good it does. It has to be kind of worthwhile in itself, you know?
In your diary, you write, "Here among the poor, the seeming irrelevance of Christ is most visible." What do you mean by that?
The religious sensibility is a refined sensibility. It requires a kind of a leisure, a kind of a reflection that is tragically so often unavailable to the poor who are busy coping, you know? And so I guess the image of what I'm doing or what I would like to be doing at best or in the deepest religious sense would be to sort of make myself and the people around the neighborhood more aware of the divine love in which I believe we all live, they and I as well, like fish in water, the love which Dante says, the love that moves the sun and the other stars. You know?
Yet it seems from your memoir that you're always dealing with your own doubts and always questioning your faith. I mean, in fact, and there's one episode in your memoir that I found very moving, really. You go to visit a mother who you know, whose son has been murdered, and friends and relatives are there, and they're all saying, it's only God that's going to get us through this. It's only our faith that will get us through this. And you're thinking about all the doubts that you have about faith.
There is a dimension of reflection that once it begins by way of philosophical exploration of the meaning of life, that is a very dark journey. And I think maybe part of what I'm saying when I look at these women who are, you know, more coping than I am, and they sort of are less critical of the ordinary answers, I kind of look at them with kind of perhaps an envy. I do realize that my education, my Irish, perhaps my bleak Irish spirit, some people sometimes accuse me of having a rather bleak Irish spirit. And, you know, Yeats warned against what he called the Celtic twilight, that madness, that whereby one sees life very unadorned, you know. My friend Robert McGovern, the artist, is very fond of these stark Irish images of, say, a blackbird pecking at a human corpse or something like that, you know, the unadorned human truth. And again, it's Simone Weil. Simone Weil said that, she said that the way that one should proceed intellectually and maybe even religiously was to take, say, a religious statement, to take it at its farthest possible extreme and see if it's still true. For example, one of the phrases we sometimes sing in church is a biblical phrase from the Psalms, "The Lord hears the cry of the poor." And I'm sitting there celebrating the Mass, and after the first reading, a cantor invites the people to sing that response and the verses of the Psalm. And I'm sitting there saying, I wonder what that means, "The Lord hears the cry of the poor." Nothing seems further from the truth. What seems true is the awful silence of God, the mystery that we call God in the face of human suffering. What does it mean to sing this biblical phrase, "The Lord hears the cry of the poor"? And so then one has to explore more deeply what it might mean. And one, if one is a believer, one say, well, it must mean something, and I think I'll try to find out more deeply what it means, since it doesn't mean what it obviously might mean.
My guest is Father John McNamee, author of the memoir Diary of a City Priest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Father John McNamee. In your book, you write about people coming to the church and asking for things and asking for money, and how sometimes, like around Christmas, people who have like no need for the church at all during the rest of the year and who are hanging out in front of liquor stores or something are suddenly knocking at the door looking for help. And I wonder how you react to that if you try to be very discriminating about who gets the favors or who gets the money and who really needs it or who's just there to hustle. Or if you feel that everybody is in fact truly in need there, whether they're using a hustle to get what they need or not.
Well, what comes to mind in considering that question of yours is a little scenario from My Fair Lady, if you remember the play in the movie with Audrey Hepburn and Rex Harrison.
Yeah.
And whenever Dr. Iggins, Rex Harrison, takes Liza Doolittle into his care in order to teach her to speak so that she can get rid of her Cockney accent and become a elegant speaking English woman, her father, this sort of hustler down in Covent Garden, he hears that his daughter, Liza Doolittle, has taken up with a fancy professor, and he goes around to see Henry Iggins. And he sort of suggests that he should have a piece of the action because, after all, she is his daughter and he should be compensated as well. Well, proper Henry Iggins is so appalled at this, he says to him, "My goodness, man, I don't believe this." He says, "You think that I've taken up with your daughter in an improper way, and not only you're not scandalized, but that you want to profit from this? And have you no morals, sir?" And Liza Doolittle's father says, "Can't afford them, Governor," you know, as though he is coping and surviving and hustling, and he doesn't have the time to the luxury of the moral reflection. And so that really doesn't bother me, people coming to me and in various stages of need and hustle and whatever. And I even have some scriptural images from the New Testament that help me. The Jesus sayings, "Don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. You have received freely, freely give. If someone wants your coat, give him your shirt as well. If someone wants you to walk a mile on the road, go 2 miles. Give to everyone who asks of you." As Father Dan Berrigan says, it's almost an invitation to be with and for others in ways that the authorities would call irresponsible.
Hmm. You know? You quote Simone Weil a lot in your book. And you quote her as saying that the charitable exchange that is real charity or real love is more rare a miracle than walking on water. And you talk in your book about how when one person gives money or clothes or something to another person, it often reinforces their mutual positions of somebody being humiliated and somebody doing the humiliating. Obviously, this is not the relationship that you want. So in the position of being a person who is always trying to give, how do you try to make it a true act of charity and not an act that reinforces the humiliation of receiving?
Well, I have a couple of other little pithy sayings that I sometimes use. I think they're from people like Gilbert Keith Chesterton, who said, "If something's worth doing, it's worth doing poorly." That's the best you can manage, you know? Or perhaps more seriously, the enemy of the good is the best.
Oh, right. Right. If you're looking for perfection, it'll just lead you to inaction.
And sometimes, I guess what made me say that from Simone Weil, sometimes I have noticed in observing my own emotions when I am called to the door once again and one of these guys is there smelling up the foyer and, you know, and I know he's got a few drinks in him. I mean, I have absolutely observed myself giving the fellow the $3 to get rid of him. It was the easiest way to discharge this interaction, you know, was, "Here, now go and get out and don't come back, or don't come back soon anyhow." So that you observe yourself, and sometimes, you know, when you're on edge with it, when, you know, it's the 15th one today, and you're on the edge of your patience with it all, you communicate that to the other fellow, and you can actually observe him absorbing this humiliation because he wants the dollars or the food or whatever, and even as you're doing it, you feel bad for not doing it better.
There's a lot of crime and vandalism in the neighborhood that you're in.
Yes.
And the church isn't exempted from that. You've had a lot of kids throwing rocks at the windows, breaking the windows at the church, mm-hmm. things stolen from the church. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how that makes you feel, if you feel that somehow the church should be protected from that, that the church is a sanctuary, that there should be respect for the religion and the church, even if it's not the religion of a person in the mm-hmm. neighborhood, they should mm-hmm. respect the institution. Or if you just feel, well, you know, it's a building like any other.
I think I sort of understand that kind of random violence or vandalism of a poor neighborhood having about the same moral character as graffiti.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't think it's so much an expression of wickedness as an expression of frustration or, you know, kind of futility. And I don't take it personal, as we say. And I'm always mindful that if we suffer this kind of harassment in the neighborhood, it's a very authentic way of being there because that's what everybody else suffers in those neighborhoods. And I wouldn't really want to be there like some god on Mount Olympus reaching down to help these mortals in their troubled lives as though my life among them were going to be intact and self-sufficient and impervious to all of that kind of harassment that is part of the life of the poor.
You write poetry.
I do, yes.
And I have a poem here that you wrote that I'd like you to read. Your father was born in Ireland, and you sometimes go to Ireland to get away, to reflect. And I believe this is a poem you wrote either in Ireland or...
Yes, I did write it in Ireland, yes.
Okay.
And I was staying with a wonderful Franciscan priest friend. I was even making a retreat with him. A retreat is a time, what the Quakers would call a quiet time.
Mm-hmm.
And on the beach there are these Martello Towers, which are very prominent in the writings of James Joyce, you know, that tortured Catholic sensibility who wrote Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake and The Dubliners and so much else. But anyhow, that area is called Sandymount. And I'm walking on that beach, and I see a sign, and that occasioned the poem. Sandymount. The black wash of Dublin Bay, and in the wet sand a sign, whoever wanders 200 meters here risk fierce incoming tides. James Joyce walked here, risked tides, went away on eagle's wings. I cautious, stay safe, walk carefully, return at last to the familiar. Kept man of the domestic church, secure, I seek further the comfort of these surroundings, chapel, sacrament, books, road maps for my rough within. My steps are measured, never beyond easy return. My hope is hinged on the promise that timid sparrows are as watched as eagles.
Reading that poem led me to wonder if you see your life as a priest as being a sign of timidity, because it almost seems from the poem that you're seeing your place within the church as being out of a need for security, and maybe an expression of timidity, although it seems to me that you've taken on so many challenges as a priest, and that it's really been more of an adventure than a safe enclave.
Yes, I think as I read the poem now at your request, I sense two things. First of all, some of the other choices that I might have made in terms of being a priest, I could have gone to that Trappist monastery, which would have been sort of a a big dive like one of those divers off those cliffs in Mexico into the surging sea, you know. Or on the other hand, there was always the fascination with the foreign missions, as we called them then, especially the Maryknoll priests. I remember when I was a boy, they were many pictures of them standing in the middle of a rice field in Manchuria with their cassocks blowing in the wind, and I didn't make those choices. And so this domestic scene seems fairly safe by comparison, although I guess we've become more aware in recent times that the local landscape is anything but safe either, or without adventure or risk. And maybe still another dimension of the poem in which I talk about Joyce being bravado, Joyce's bravado and my timidity, has to do with this sense of sometimes feeling that this society of ours is profoundly unreal over against the rest of the world, the kinds of things that occupy us, the kinds of things that concern us, and even the political agenda or the social agenda, you know. And so sometimes I think, what am I doing living in this society? I mean, I think I really would have a harder time living in, say, a suburban parish where people were asking me to help them with programs for marriage enrichment. And maybe one of the reasons I am in North Philadelphia is the idea not to be so secure and to live in society that is so unreal.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Father John McNamee is the author of Diary of a City Priest, published by Sheed and Ward. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.